Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box.
Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to the latest episode of the Film Stories podcast. Kicking it off with a bit of a song on this one. You ready? I'll use as much of it as I'm legally allowed to do, and then I have to quickly cut to this.
Come with me,
and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that had stories.
The story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, that's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, well, title gives it away, really. I'm here to talk of the stories of film. And I tend to talk about production stories, development stories, marketing stories, release stories, all those bits and bobs that go to make the films that we know and sometimes love. Just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to choose for this podcast, they have more of a mainstream leaning to them than anything else. They're films I'm also interested in or invested in to some degree. I try not to do snark. I try not to punch down. I just think it's really hard to make a film. I want to celebrate the fact that films are made. And I'm a huge, huge, huge lover of cinema. I just kind of want to get that across, really, and just celebrate it all. Without further ado, I'm going to crack on with the first of the two films I'm talking about in this episode. We're going back to the 2000s. I'm going to play you a clip. I'll come to the story, as always, the other side of this.
When I was your age, they would say we could become cops or criminals. What I'm saying is this. When you're facing a loaded gun, what's the difference?
This is not the regular police. This is the state police.
We are an elite unit.
This is who we're after.
Frank Costello.
You won't be paid as a regular cop, but there's a bonus involved.
So what do I do?
You will not ever know the identity of undercover people.
You have anyone in with Costello presently?
Maybe.
Do you know who I am?
Maybe not.
I'm gonna have my associates search you.
That was quick. Think he's dead already?
Get your hands off me!
I think we could work something out.
We are all convinced that Costello has at least one mole inside the Special Investigations Unit.
There are parts of my job I can't talk to you about.
Man, you are trouble.
You don't know the half of it.
You better get organized, quick.
That then was a clip from 2006's The Film That Won Martin Scorsese an Oscar, otherwise occasionally known also as The Departed, directed by Scorsese, screenplay by William Monaghan, based on the film Infernal Affairs that was written by Alan Mack and Felix Chong and was directed by Andrew Lau. The cast of the American version of the film, led by Leonardo DiCaprio, Matt Damon, Jack Nicholson, Mark Wahlberg, Martin Sheen, Ray Winston and his accent, Vera Farmiga and Alec Baldwin. And it's somewhat inevitably, given that this was a remake, the story of it goes back to that original film. It was the 2002 movie Infernal Affairs, and I was working in an office in Birmingham with someone who was importing, legally I should add, Region 3 DVDs, and he found Infernal Affairs early and went on and on and on about it, and the word must have made it to Scorsese. It's down to him, surely. So the film was something of a word-of-mouth sensation, if you knew about it, which sounds a bit stating the obvious, but this was a foreign language movie that was very slowly making its way through the world. But also the Hollywood rights to this were available, and there were a pair of bidders showing interest. So on the one hand, you had Brad Pitt's company, Plan B. Now, Plan B at that point was coming to the end of its deal with Warner Brothers, but it still had some discretionary funds available, but would need to empty the piggy bank of its Warner Brothers allowance, basically, to be able to buy this film. It was bidding against the Weinstein Company, headed up at the time by convicted rapist Harvey Weinstein. And it was, in this case, it was Brad Pitt's company that managed to find the extra coins. $1.75 million it cost to secure the American rights to The Departed. For a while, that was with the idea that Pitt would star in it himself in one of the roles, but that would change over time as he sort of realised he was probably a bit too old for it. I mean, initially, I remember a story that Tom Cruise was linked, but then Tom Cruise was linked with every film towards the start of the 2000s. Nonetheless, under the stewardship of Plan B, William Monahan in 2003 was hired to pen the screenplay for the American take on the movie. Now, Monahan hadn't watched the original film, so he said, but he duly got to work on it. Warner Brothers was interested. I mean, it saw the potential here, given the mob roots of the movie that was going to happen, that this would be a great project for Martin Scorsese. Now, Scorsese was in an interesting part of his career here, because I think it's fair to say it was the era where he was taking films, consciously or subconsciously, that were more likely to earn him Oscar gold. It had become something of a narrative that Scorsese hadn't won an Oscar and was being overlooked. And so, for instance, he did the Gangs of New York, which I talked about in a previous episode of the podcast, and he did The Aviator as well, and there were real Oscar hopes for both of those, but none of them brought home Oscar gold for Scorsese. So, I mean, when he was offered The Departed, he didn't see it as an awards film at all. In fact, he would give interviews afterwards that at no point during the making of this did he even think about awards. He saw it as a B-movie. He saw this as just going a little bit away from the huge films that he'd been making over the years before. He wasn't keen on the idea of doing a remake, but he did take a look at the script that Monahan had written, and he liked it. He also, though, wasn't too keen to work with a studio on a thriller, because as soon as it becomes a studio thriller, it's going to go down certain paths. He'd had ups and downs with studios in the past. But he still toyed with doing The Departed for a little while, and he dropped in and out of the project. And in the meantime, Monahan kept working on the screenplay. Warner Brothers, meanwhile, well, it was quite pleased with what it had here, and it sensed real potential, because could he get a Scorsese and Robert De Niro reunion? I mean, the two of them hadn't worked together at that point since, what, Casino in the mid-90s? And, I mean, again, the Hollywood trade press was not shy of speculation. Would they work together again? Of course, they did with The Irishman a few years ago. I'm sure I'll come back to that on the podcast at some point. But Robert De Niro was linked with the key role of Frank Costello in the film that was now The Departed. This would reunite Scorsese and De Niro. And also, I mean, as Tom Sean pointed out in his excellent book that I've cited a few quotes from in this, the book is Martin Scorsese by Tom Sean. This was also, for the first time in, 20 years, going to be a Scorsese film set in the present day if he took the picture on. There was enough in it that in the end Scorsese was persuaded, and it was that idea of doing a B picture that really appealed to him on this. He also, Leonardo DiCaprio, who had been working with Scorsese on several films by this point, well, he'd read it and he'd got interested too. And what Scorsese was drawn to as well was the fact that he felt the film was similar in tone, and based on the script that he read, to a film that he loved, the 1930s movie White Heat with James Cagney. It's worth noting that Scorsese was adamant as well that he hadn't watched the original film. The story goes he didn't realise it was a remake until he committed connected to it. Meanwhile, in the backdrop of all of this, well, some changes at Plan B. It was moving to it was moving towards Paramount. The film Babel was the one that Brad Pitt himself was going to get more involved in. I think it's pretty well known that Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston, who were running the company at that point, were separating and would divorce. And so this was kind of a new era for Plan B, really. But also it became clear that the project was probably a little bit too big just for the one production company. So a call went into a man called Graham King, who now runs GK Films. Now, he'd helped put together funding on Gangs of New York and The Aviator. And the idea was that Graham King would be a producer on the movie, that Plan B would dilute its interest, but would still be involved. And with all this in mind, the film was gradually getting to the point of getting up and running. It was felt at first it was going to cost, what, about $40, $45 million to make. And Scorsese could muscle down, really, to the idea of casting the film. So it was the writer Kenneth Lonergan, and director, of course, the wonderful You Can Count on Me, who, for instance, would suggest Matt Damon would be a good choice for the everyman role of Colin Sullivan in the movie. And Damon duly signed on the dotted line. De Niro, though, turned down that role of Frank Costello. The offer did go into him, but instead he decided he was going to direct another movie of his own. He'd done A Bronx Tale at this point, and now he wanted to do a film called The Good Shepherd. And ironically enough, Leonardo DiCaprio was linked with The Good Shepherd and dropped out of that movie to do The Departed. And Matt Damon, who was in The Departed, nonetheless went to do The Good Shepherd. So I'm not quite sure how that worked, but that's how it panned out. With De Niro thus turning the role down, was Scorsese. He'd been wanting to work with Al Pacino. And so an offer reportedly went into Pacino for the senior statesman role in the movie, the mob boss Frank Costello. And Pacino also turned the movie down. And Pacino would, of course, he would also work with Scorsese when The Irishman came around. And so Scorsese turned to another person he'd been keen to work with, someone he'd known for many, many, many years, who he'd talked to about doing a project together with. But again, one hadn't come together. That man, of course, was Jack Nicholson. And as Scorsese would explain to Tom Sharon, he said, "I wanted a real presence to carry over the whole picture, so that even if he was only in three scenes," and that gives you a clue as to just how much Costello was in the script that William Monahan had originally put together, "you would still feel the presence of this larger-than-life, almost godlike figure." And so the pitch for the role went out to Jack Nicholson, and he considered it, and Jack Nicholson, he said no. So they were a little bit in limbo at this point. They needed someone of his gravitas for the role, but they went back to Nicholson and he had a meeting with Scorsese, with Monahan and Leonardo DiCaprio all together. And in the end, he agreed to take the film on. He liked the idea in particular of doing something a bit more villainous. He'd been doing some slightly more pleasant protagonist roles to that point, and this one just felt a bit more gnarly and a bit more nasty. With Nicholson on board, William Monahan loaded up his copy of Final Draft again, and he reworked the script again, and he beefed up the role of Costello and made him more of a presence, more of a physical presence in the film, and gave Nicholson more material to do. And so it got to the point that by the start of 2005, so this was 2 years after Monahan had been hired, the film had been given the green light by Warner Brothers. But the attraction of the talent, because by this point the cast was DiCaprio, it was Damon, it was Nicholson. These were three actors who in theory could, certainly in the olden days, open a movie by themselves. Well, they were going to cost some serious money, and the price of the film had duly gone up. No longer was this a $45 million B picture. This was now $90 million, and this was very high on Warner Brothers' radar. It also knew it had a Scorsese movie as well. There's some prestige to that. But interestingly, of that $90 million, half of it was just going to pay the talent in the movie. It's one of those where if this had been put together as an indie film and an indie production, then the talent involved may have worked for scale, may have worked for a very small upfront fee in exchange for back end. But this was Warner Brothers. No one was going to go up to Warner Brothers and look at them and think they were short of a bit of cash. Everyone charged their fee. Warner Brothers had to stump up $90 million. And I mean, interestingly, the international rights to the film didn't all stick with Warner Brothers. I mean, it came to a company called Entertainment Film Distributors here in the UK, which accounts for the slightly spotty disc release we've got over here. The smaller supporting roles in the movie, well, they were coming together too. And I mean, typical for a Scorsese movie, they were having some real impact. These weren't forgettable background artists. I mean, take Vera Farmiga, who auditioned and fought for her role in the film and gives a terrific performance in there. Mel Gibson was offered a role, but he was in the midst of directing Apocalypto at the moment. I'd argue that's the best film that Mel Gibson has directed. And so Gibson dropped out, and Alec Baldwin came in and joined the ensemble in the role that he took on. Peter Mullen, wonderful Peter Mullen, actor and director, he joined the film for a little while, but he too would ultimately drop out of this one. The role of Dignam, meanwhile, was, well, Dennis Leary and Ray Liotta were in the running for that one, but an offer went into Mark Wahlberg. It was a bit about against type for the kind of films he was making at the time, and he turned that role down a few times before ultimately accepting it. And the core cast was now together ahead of a start of production in the spring of 2005. And as always, Scorsese brought his cast together and screened some films as reference points to the cast and the crew. So T-Men and Raw Deal from director Anthony Mann, notably Howard Hawks's Scarface, was screened to them. And Scorsese would repeat visual tricks from that particular take on Scarface throughout The Departed. Also a film by William Wellman called The Public Enemy. And everything was together. This was going to run. It was a film that was set in Boston. And when filming began in the spring of 2005, well, most of it didn't take place in Boston, as it happened. Most of the filming for this one would take place in and around the New York area. They filmed on sets in New York. And the reason for this was, in part, the ballooning cost of the project, that they were taking advantage of, at the time, generous tax breaks in New York, which brought the, I think it was a 15% tax break or something like that, which Boston couldn't offer. So while they went off and did some location work in Boston as well, just to get some establishing shots and things like that, the bulk of this movie would shoot in New York, still far enough away from Hollywood, but nonetheless not quite where the film was set. And the shooting would go through on this one from towards the end of April 2005. Actually, it'd be quite a long shoot. It wouldn't wrap up until the end of August 2005, but they got an awful lot in the can in that period of time. So, I mean, take, for instance, Jack Nicholson on the set of a film like this. DiCaprio has given more than one interview talking about just what an experience it was for him in the key scene. I'm going spoiler light here, in the key scene that he takes on with Nicholson in The Departed. And he talked about just the level of improvisation. And it was the same with Matt Damon, actually. It's just like the story goes that one night Matt Damon took a phone call from Scorsese, who told him that Jack Nicholson had some ideas for the scene they were going to do the following day. And so Damon's just like, oh yeah, really interested. So Scorsese says, okay, I'll just get to it. Jack's going to wear a dildo. You heard that right. And Damon just thinking, all right. And so the next day, Jack Nicholson turns up and he says, I'm not doing a Jack Nicholson impression, but he says to Damon, just like, here's the deal. I'm going to come in. I'm going to sit there in my overcoat and I'm going to pull out the big dildo and we're going to laugh. And he did, and they did. And Nicholson would continually try things. He was given a lot of freedom to improvise with his character. I mean, it's said that the character was loosely based on the real-life Boston gangster Whitey Bulger, whose story would be told in the film Black Mass. Johnny Depp would play him in that movie. And so he was sketched roughly around, certainly, the image of Bulger. But Nicholson was bringing a lot of his ideas to this as well. And DiCaprio certainly found this out. Because what Nicholson wanted was for DiCaprio's character to be scared of Frank Costello. And so he was going to surprise Leonardo DiCaprio to try and unnerve him while they were shooting, again, a key sequence between the two. But DiCaprio was tipped off with this one. He was tipped off by one of the prop team that Nicholson had asked for a gun, some matches, a fire extinguisher and a bottle of whiskey. I don't know where he put his dildo, but that had clearly gone by that point. And they ran several takes of the sequence, again, that I'm going to spoiler light on, with Nicholson and DiCaprio face to face. One of the takes, he managed to set fire to the table between them. But DiCaprio would explain there was tons of improvisation. He said, I was never sure which side of Costello he was going to be playing on any particular day. And he admitted it makes you terrified as an actor and it ups the stakes. And it certainly remains a memorable scene in the movie itself. There were little bits of scheduling problems in and around the movie as well, just to accommodate the actors, because it's quite a big cast on this one. So, I mean, Wahlberg's stuff, for instance, would have to be shot right at the start, given his commitments to other projects. Vera Farmiga's stuff was shot at the end. But the bulk of it was Damon and DiCaprio with key appearances from Jack Nicholson, again, in and around the bulk of the New York and also the Boston, Massachusetts area of the shoot. Now, the film wrapped up, and this is where I think this is the bit where Martin Scorsese stopped enjoying the making of the Departed so much. And again, he's talked about this since. But it goes back to the fact that the movie was a studio movie. Now, he'd just been making films with Weinstein, for instance, and he hadn't particularly enjoyed that experience either. Weinstein's interference on Gangs of New York, again, I've covered before, but you think you hire a director of the significance and stature of Scorsese and give him a little bit of room, not as much as you might think. And because this was a $90 million Warner Brothers movie, it had to go through the Warner Brothers studio testing process. This wasn't a small indie as far as the studio was concerned. This was a major deal. And so Warner Brothers insisted on its traditional program of preview screenings and testing for the movie. And so, I mean, Scorsese was ultimately resigned to this. And going back to that Tom Shon book, he said that the film cost a lot of money. There were big name stars in it, and therefore I had to work with the studio very closely. And he said, screen it, argue it, discuss it, you know. And he says, we stuck to our guns with the film, but there was real pushback from studio executives. Scorsese would say we got pretty much what we wanted, though that there were a couple of things here and there we didn't get. That doesn't really matter, he would argue. The thing is, I don't know if it's worth going through the process again. Now, he'd done a studio thriller, of course, before with Cape Fear. Again, I've covered this on a previous episode of the podcast. But, the glaring eyes were far more on this, and this one involved a lot more financial expense and expectation. And it's also worth noting as well that in the mid-2000s, studios were making fewer movies than they were when he'd made Cape Fear with Universal. And thus, the glare was more intense on the films that they tended to be making. Warner Brothers had concerns, and this is not atypical when it comes to Scorsese movies, on the length of the film. It wanted this down to a commercial length. This needed to be a commercial project for the studio to at least stand a chance of getting its money back. And so Scorsese had to keep trimming his film. It would come down to 151 minutes in the end. Warner Brothers still wanted another 10 minutes, really. But it was a painful process going back to and fro. Thelma Schumacher, who's Scorsese's regular editor, did construct some superb stuff. I mean, the tempo of the opening of the Departed is really, really, really quite something. But it was taking a long, long time for this to come together. I mean, if you think the filming wrapped up, the end of August 1995, and it was over a year before we'd see the final cut of the movie, which in the era of editing films on digital, I would suggest is rare. Nonetheless, it was also that Scorsese was working on another project at the same time that he was doing his Rolling Stones documentary film, Shine a Light. And as part and parcel of making Shine a Light, he needed to be in New York. And the film was, I assume the film was being edited in Los Angeles, but he needed to get back to New York to shoot the concert material he needed for Shine a Light. But the editing was crawling along in LA. And there was a problem actually towards the end of it as well, where a computer lab malfunction delayed the last part of the editing of The Departed by 2 days, and Scorsese simply had to go. He'd had his fill. He upped and went. And the result of that is he neither approved the final print of the movie, the absolute final print of the movie, nor would he see it for the first time until the premiere of the movie. I mean, that sounds pretty much unheard of, really, for a Scorsese film for me. Now, the film, the actual core film itself, I mean, it's not bereft of details. For instance, look out for the X's in the film. Whenever you see an X, well, there's a tip of the hat to the original Scarface that I mentioned in that, but it's also a bit of foreshadowing. There's loads of little details scattered throughout. And clearly, the actual production bit, he seemed to have a ball doing it. The movie would it debuted in America first with a September release. It was it premiered on September the 26th, 2006, before getting its wide release on October the 6th, 2006. So there's a little bit of space there, a little bit of a platform release, and then a little bit of, and then a lot of a very broad release as well. And the response to the film was really, really, really strong. That the reviews came in, they weren't classing it as absolute prime gold Scorsese, but this was a really well done, very violent, incredibly sweary movie as well, it's worth noting. Pretty much every swear word, just bang them all in and tons of them. But it would appear on best of lists, and it was clear that this film too, as well as getting good reviews, was becoming an unlikely, when you think back to how it all came about and the expectations of it, Oscar frontrunner. The film's opening weekend, because it was that slow platform release, it was a little bit shy at first, but then it opened wide in the US, October the 6th to the 8th, with $26.8 million, a huge opening for a Scorsese movie, and it knocked the animation open season down to third place. That had been top of the chart the week before. What else do we have opening that week? Glad you asked. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Beginning, that opened in second place the same week with $19 million. Spoiler, that didn't go on to win Best Picture at the Oscars, nor did the film that opened in fourth place, Employee of the Month, that was up against it with $11 million. Kevin Costner movie in there, The Guardian, that was that was down to five on its second week of release. The other opening was Trailer Park Boys the movie, which opened with about $1 million and pretty much disappeared not long after that. The Departed, though, was also building on word of mouth. And whilst it was knocked off the top of the chart the week after by The Grudge 2, also a remake, it held most of its business, and it continued to stick around in the top, well, in the top three, really, for several weeks afterwards. It would ultimately go on in the US. Its American gross would come in at $132 million, which was sky high as far as Scorsese films were going. I think it's been beaten since. I don't think it had then. But also, it was an international hit for Warner Brothers as well, even though Warner's didn't hold all the international rights. Another $159 million outside of the US. And this one grossed nearly $300 million. But its story had not been completed because, I mean, you know it's coming. It attracted the interest of the Oscars and then some. It got, in the end, five Oscar nominations for Best Picture, for Best Director, for Best Adapted Screenplay, for Best Film Editing, and for Mark Wahlberg, Best Performance by an Actor in a Supporting Role. And then the moment, finally, in 2007... came the moment where Steven Spielberg, Francis Ford Coppola, and George Lucas stood on the Oscar stage to present the Best Picture Oscar. Scorsese's name was read out, and I think in this little clip from the start of his acceptance speech, you can still hear the surprise in his voice.
Thank you. Thank you. Please. Thank you. Could you double check the envelope? Thank you. I'm overwhelmed with this honor with the Academy, and also the honor of being presented by my old friends. We go back 37 years. I'm so moved.
And that ordinarily would have been that, but for the fact that there was talk for a little while of doing a sequel to The Departed. William Monaghan certainly picked up that idea and penned a screenplay or two. It's worth noting that the film it's based on, Infernal Affairs, had a couple of sequels. But in the end, it kind of petered out a little bit. Scorsese wasn't massively interested in doing a sequel to this one. And instead, it sort of refueled him a little bit. In fact, he would go on to another studio thriller straight afterwards, Shutter Island with Paramount. And over the course of the following decade, I mean, films such as Silence, The Wolf of Wall Street and The Irishman. And at the point this podcast has been recorded, they're now filming Flowers of the Killer Moon. It feels like a man refueled and just continuing and continuing and continuing to put his love of film on screen. And then one final thing just on The Departed. Once the dust had settled, once the film had been released, once it had been received in the way it had, Scorsese finally watched Infernal Affairs. Which brings me to the halfway point of this latest episode of Film Story. So I'm just going to do a little bit of any other business in the middle. First and foremost, I am an independent. I am one person in a room. I don't have a company behind me of any note or significance. I don't have a marketing budget or anything like that. The only reason this podcast has got as far as it has, and it's nearly at episode 200, is thanks to the support of you, that you, loads of people out there have subscribed to this podcast, have supported it on Patreon at patreon.com/SimonBrew, have subscribed and left really positive reviews as well. If you can do any of those things, that helps me enormously. If you are supporting me on Patreon, I've also put up a clip, the audio of my last live show in Birmingham. It's a little bit rickety, but hopefully you like it. And I've just put tickets on sale for my next live show, which is taking place in September 2021 in Birmingham. You'll be able to find out all about that on the Film Stories website at filmstories.co.uk. I think that's enough plugs and business, though, for the middle of this. I want to get on with the second of the two films I'm talking about in this episode. As always, I'm going to play you a clip. We'll come to the story the other side of this. It's love. Yes, all we're looking for is love from someone else. A rush. A glance. A touch. To light up the skies, to open the world and send it real. A voice that says I'll be here and you'll be alright. I don't care if I know just where I will go, cause all that I need is that crazy feeling like I tapped out of my heart. Think I want it to stay. I could listen to the rest of that for a very, very long time. But the problem is I would obviously get sued for using too much of the clip. So I better get down to business. That is a clip from 2006's delightful La La Land, written and directed by Damien Chazelle, with a cast led by Ryan Gosling, Emma Stone, John Legend and Rosemary DeWitt. Where I should mention from the start, from the off as well, that the music for this one was done by Justin Hurwitz and the choreography was done by Mandy Moore, but not that one. Now, Damien Chazelle, I mean, he always loved musicals and he always loved movies. That he loved old star Hollywood musicals. And he was, I mean, he just loved that classic era of Hollywood. And so, I mean, there's an argument. He was always destined to be a filmmaker. And he was in his early 20s, really, when he moved to LA in 2008 and found himself in a very lonely place, really, that he would. I mean, he would use the experiences that he was going through at that point and put facets of that into the main characters in the film that would become La La Land. But also he would find his way to Harvard Film School. And the film that was originally intended to be his thesis movie would be a small, a minuscule budget jazz musical by the name of Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench. Now, he would work on that with his friend from Harvard Film School, a man called Justin Hurwitz. That's very useful to have him as a friend, I would suggest. And the film came, he got it finished, 2010. It sort of came and went, really. But also around this time, he was completing the first draft of a script that was really a kind of drawback to the Hollywood musicals of old. Also marrying that up to a love letter to the city of Los Angeles. He'd written what would become La La Land. Now he just needed to get it made. I mean, he'd had the idea while he was at Harvard. He talked about it with Justin Hurwitz, who would go on to do the music. But would Hollywood buy a musical about basically a jazz musician? And no, Hollywood absolutely would not. It would be fair to say that at the start of the 2010s, musicals were a tough sell. I mean, go back to how, even a few years later, how difficult it was to get The Greatest Showman through the Hollywood system, even with Hugh Jackman on board. This one didn't have a movie star. It didn't have an existing intellectual property to base on. It was an original musical done by unknowns. And bluntly, it just wasn't going to happen, certainly as things were there. It's worth noting, there was the occasional flicker of interest in it. There was a story that Focus Features offered around $1 million to do it as an ultra low budget film, but that came with conditions that if you're going to do it, you can't do it with a jazz musician. Who'd want to watch a film about that? So the idea would be change one of the characters to a rock musician. That's easier to sell. Also, that big opening sequence, take that out as well. Let's change that. Change the melancholic ending. And this to and fro really led to Chazelle resisting the changes and Focus dropping out of the film. And so what Chazelle did is he realised that the time was not right for this, and he started putting his energies into another project that he started after he'd written this one. Now, that other project would be the short film. It would be Whiplash, which he made a short version of it first to try and get the feature of it done. The short version of it was a hit at Sundance. Then he made the long version that was a hit at Sundance, and Whiplash firmly put Chazelle on the map. I think Whiplash is a masterpiece, personally. The last 20 minutes of that film, as I've discussed in the podcast where I looked at the making of that, is the tensest I've felt from a Hollywood movie in a long, long, long time. Grip the rest off the arm tension with that. I just thought it was incredible. But Whiplash, a couple of things. Number one, three things, really, that Hollywood liked. Number one, it was cheap. Number two, it was a hit. Number three, it won Oscars. And so all of a sudden, Damien Chazelle was your go-to person. That he was the one that Hollywood studios wanted to talk to. And, you know, what else did he have? And, I mean, he reflected on this in a long piece with the Hollywood Reporter, because he was talking about how do you justify a musical today? And he said the way to justify it today is actually go back to a lot of those traditions of the older movies. And so he talked about why it had to be done in a certain way. And he would add to the Los Angeles Times, when he just tried to describe the film he was trying to get off the ground, he said, it's this weird movie that needs to be both a fantastical musical at a certain scale and yet this realistic love story. And he said all that, plus it's a pretty young team in terms of me and Justin, unknown and unproven. It's one thing if it's an original musical with a songwriter people know. This is me and my college friends saying, hey, trust us. And so the only point where Hollywood was willing to consider trusting them really was after Whiplash hit big. And in the aftermath of its success, in came Summit Entertainment, owned now by Lionsgate, with interest in the film at a point where the key cast was likely to be led by Emma Watson and Miles Teller. They were certainly the two who were linked with it when it became clear that this might actually be happening. The production company Black Label Media came in at this point as well, and there looked like finally there was a path to bring this to the screen. Now, it was one of those, there's a story that goes around that one of the executives involved with it just urged Chazelle just to make it slightly more expensive, because it was being pitched at something like $20 million to make. But the whole idea of if you are going to do this old style Hollywood musical that they don't make anymore, you really commit to it, you really go for it. And so he did. I mean, they pushed that, and he kept working on the script and working on the script and working on the script. And then the casting, well, it just started to bubble up, and, well, a couple of stories came to light. I mean, first is a nice nice little irony to it that Emma Watson would turn the film down so she could take on the one of the lead roles in Disney's live action remake of Beauty and the Beast. So she turned it down for that. Ryan Gosling would turn down Disney's live action remake of Beauty and the Beast so he could star in La La Land. I quite like that. With the Summit and Lionsgate financial investment, the casting was altering, and it was felt that Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone already had chemistry in place. They'd been in a well-liked film that not enough people have seen, really, Crazy Stupid Love. They'd also crossed on Gangster Squad, which a film with a story and a half behind it as well, that hadn't gone down quite as well. And Chazelle was now edging towards them for his leads. And so in the midst of all of this was Miles Teller, who had been the lead in Whiplash. He didn't win the Oscar for it, but his performance at the heart of Whiplash is a large part of why it works. And a few years after La La Land spiked, he threw a slightly different shade on the story that was doing the rounds. In fact, he also did it just before, in the year before the film was released, because Teller had felt that he was due to do La La Land. He was said he was attached to the film for a while. But in September 2015, he was told by his agent he was no longer aboard the movie. Now, the internet tittle-tattle story that was doing the rounds suggested that the reason for this was he wanted $6 million to star in the film rather than the $4 million he'd been offered. But Teller rejected that firmly. He would tell Vulture that when that movie was almost falling apart, I stayed attached to it. I told directors that I really wanted to work with that, I couldn't jump ship from La La Land just because the project was in flux. And he said, I'll go to my grave knowing that when push came to shove, I expressed extreme loyalty to Damien in that movie. That's sort of all I can say. He did, it's worth noting, also add that when it's a film that he really wants to do, he's not going to turn it down because he's been offered $4 million rather than $6 million. So this went backwards and forwards a little bit. And so next time Chazelle did an interview, he would talk to Uproxx and he just said, I probably just won't say anything about anything he said in the interview. He said, talking of Teller's story that he put out there, he said, except what I will say is that the casting of this movie during the 6 years it took to get made went through lots of permutations. And it's true, there was a moment when Emma Watson and Miles Teller were doing it, and neither of those casting things wound up lasting or working out. But it was part of the up and down and making of this movie, he argued, that we were about to make it, we were about to not make it. And I mean, he would talk just the whole process of trying to get it off the ground. I mean, he mentioned this to the Hollywood Reporter. He said everything felt like a complete mess and a complete jungle. It was a moment where it felt like it was never going to come together, and then it started to come together. That the budget pushed up to $30 million, that Emma Stone, turns out she'd always been a fan of musicals, and also she'd starred on Broadway in Cabaret as well. The film was coming together, Gosling was on board, and finally there was a path to getting La La Land made. Against the backdrop of this, Justin Herzl was writing 6 original songs for the film, but also at the point that Gosling and Stone committed, well, boy, did they have to commit, because there was 4 months of preparation the pair would have to put in for their roles in this film, and they would do that preparation at a warehouse space that was hired in Los Angeles, and they would be in separate rooms. Stone would be working on her dancing. Gosling was learning just the basics of being a jazz pianist. And they were gradually building the film up, building the choreography. They were changing the songs. They were changing the script. Meanwhile, Chazelle, as the cast and crew built up more and more, he would host screenings of movies, what Scorsese was doing, really, at the end of every week, of the films that really had inspired him to come to La La Land in the first place. And they were films like The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, They're Singing in the Rain, Top Hat. He also screened Boogie Nights, and Boogie Nights is a film I love that I'm coming to in a future podcast as well. But it was 4 months of rehearsals before they could start shooting this movie. And And the shooting didn't start until the summer of 2015. Just before that, in came J.K. Simmons, who'd won an Oscar for Whiplash. He rounded off the cast for it. But just to give you an idea of just the level of perfectionism they were driving at, the City of Stars song that I just played you a little clip of just right at the start of this segment took her, it's a reported 31 times to get right before Damien Chazelle was happy with it. They were tuning it to the nth degree. Then it came to the shoot. Now, this was an ambitious location-driven shoot. The film was to be a love letter to Los Angeles, and thus it needed to show a lot of Los Angeles. And the prologue to the film, the huge song and dance sequence that you get right at the start of the movie, if you've not seen it, it's just a real delight. That, for a start, involved the closing of a Los Angeles highway for a weekend. Now, that was in August 2015 when it got up and running. And in fact, the highway is one that winds into the sky a little bit. And the plan hadn't been to shoot there originally. There was a stretch of road that had been identified in LA that was just flatter. But then Chazelle saw this bigger stretch of road and just like, he wanted that. He was really going to push to get this going. And he knew that if he was going to do it, if he was going to bring the Los Angeles landscape to the screen, he had to look for dramatic stuff like that. And so there they were, that first weekend of shooting. He was shooting on celluloid. I mean, he wanted to try and match the old CinemaScope aspect ratio of those old classic movies he was referencing, but that aspect ratio is no longer available, but he got as close as he could to it. He also wanted to shoot the musical numbers in one take. He didn't want to do this in a very bits and pieces kind of way. So that added an extra demand to the 100 or so dancers who were on that Los Angeles highway that weekend. It helped too that it was a Los Angeles summer and a half, that the temperature was up to 100 degrees that weekend, and they had 48 hours just to get the opening, and that was just the beginning. This was a challenge that the shoot would cover 40 days in the end. It would take them to around 60 different locations around the Los Angeles area, some easier to procure than others, some derelict, some had to be resurrected a little bit. Not everything that they could get. And against the backdrop of this, you had Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling, whose characters, I mean, for performances, they were taking a real leap here. That there are moments in the film, going spoiler light, where they go from a very grounded moment to all of a sudden they're up in the air. And all the while, they had to make it believable. And Stone would be open about this in interviews she gave coming up to the film's release, that it would take her a couple of weeks just to get over her nerves, because this was something out of the comfort zone of pretty much everyone who was making the film. Now, one of the things that Chazelle would argue is that they figured something out in older musicals in terms of how to shoot dance sequences. And he argued that Hollywood had unlearned it. Now, this isn't a massive surprise. When the studio system of Hollywood in the 30s, 40s and 50s was in existence, it was very easy to set up one production, move straight on to the next. And as such, there was a light that it was worth keeping a whole load of dance movie personnel and skills on the payroll, just move them on to the next production. But Hollywood hadn't been making these films. And so there was a kind of rebuilding that element of work approach from scratch again, that as much as they had the reference points, they were struggling throughout just to capture the right tone. I mean, there's sequences where, again, I'm going to spoil a lot as I can, the sequence where up they go into the air, I mean, it had to work. It had to tonally be believable. But also, Chazelle didn't want to pull back on the big moments like that, because it came back to, if this is your chance to do a big old style Hollywood musical, you've got to go for it. Now, it's a Hollywood story as well, and both Stone and Gosling would bring their own often excruciating and real-life audition experiences that they've been through to the making of the movie to put into their work. Stone, for instance, has an audition in the film, and it features something that happened to Ryan Gosling in real life when he was performing in the middle of a crying moment. He told this to the Los Angeles Times, and the casting director in that audition just took a phone call in the middle of the audition, that they'd have people who never looked up, and all of those little moments that they brought into their roles, and they just add these little nuances to the performances. It's also worth noting that there's one final challenging moment where, again, there's a sunset sequence in the movie with a whole load of natural light in it, and they're on location. They're not on a soundstage for this bit. And thus, they couldn't fake it. They were at the mercy of the weather, although it was, a very hot summer, and it was a very summery summer, for want of a better way of putting it. Still took 2 nights to just capture all the sunsets and to get it absolutely right. But they got it in the can in the end, and La La Land could finally wrap up its challenging shoot. Well, I think the end of September, early October 2015. But the thing is, I mean, the journey was still going to be a long one, that the post-production on La La Land took an awfully long time in the context of modern movies, certainly in the digital editing era. That Tom Cross was the editor working with Chazelle on it, and they were it took them a long, long time to get the kind of magical tone they wanted for the piece, to get the colour palette right in the movie, and just basically to make the whole thing gel. And it's not like they weren't testing it either. They were having, early test screenings took place in 2016, and they were just not working. And Chazelle, again, was open about this, talking to the Hollywood Reporter. He just said, we'd see that part of the movie just wasn't working at all. He said, you'd get hurt for a second, but then you have to regroup and figure it out. And he said the challenge was finding that balance between the fantastical romantic musical numbers and the story about a young couple trying to achieve their dreams. And he said it took a while to find the movie. And sometimes we weren't positive we could find the balance we wanted. But also, it was taking a long time. And Lionsgate had earmarked this for release in July 2016. It was going to be a summer release. But as reported in Entertainment Weekly, the film was on track to be finished, but pretty early on in the post-production process, it started to not feel like exactly the right place or context for the movie. And then once the date change became official, Chazelle confirmed, he said, we made use of the extra time. Lionsgate put the film's wide release back to the December of that year, but also it didn't give them a lot of extra time because Lionsgate wanted it to play the festival circuit and build up word of mouth, with the idea that by the time the film did come to its wide release, it would be a movie that loads of people would be talking about. As such, Chazelle did not lock the final cut of La La Land until, I seem to get it to the start of August 2016, and it debuted at the Venice Film Festival in 2016 at the end of that August. So it was done just a couple of weeks before it premiered for the first time. And, Chazelle would talk about how he didn't see much of that original screening either, that he had his eyes closed for the first part, and he just felt the feeling in the room was off, that he thought it was tanking. He described that to the Hollywood Reporter. He didn't buy the end, though, when he got a huge standing ovation and the accolades and the reviews started rolling in. And the film festival circuit was incredibly kind to it, and deservedly so as well. I mean, notably, when it went to the Telluride Film Festival, Tom Hanks was there. Now, he was doing a Q&A for the film Sully, directed by Clint Eastwood, and as part of the promotional circuit for that movie, and he interrupted it to bang the drum for La La Land. When was the last time you remember anyone doing this? And he says, he's reported as saying, when you see something that is brand new, that you can't imagine, and you just think, thank God this has landed, because I think a movie like La La Land would be anathema to studios. That number one, it is a musical, and number two, nobody knows the songs. And Hanks really went out to bat for the film. And I mean, by the time it came to the London Film Festival that autumn, you struggled to get a ticket for the film. I mean, the word of mouth was going off the chart for this one. And by the time December rolled around, the award nominations were starting to rack up as well. And it flew into cinemas on December the 9th in the US. And I mean, its opening weekend was, it was only on a few screens. The opening weekend, December the 9th to the 11th, they opened it on 5 screens. Its per screen average was $176,000. The nearest per screen average in the chart that was that week was doing a tenth of that business. I mean, it was Moana had actually opened a couple of weeks before. That was top of the box office chart that week. But when it came to the wide release of La La Land and the upping of the number of screens, well, it was gradual, actually. It went up to 200 screens the week after and shot up to number 7 in the charts when Rogue One, A Star Wars Story was cleaning up. I will come to that at some point as well. And the screen count gradually started to inch up and up and up and up. And La La Land's box office, well, it was consistent in the top 10 for a long time. It didn't cross 1,000 screens until a month after its release, which is when it broke into the top 5, added another 10 million to its box office take, and it just kept coming. Then it went up to second at the box office, and by the time its American run alone was done with, this risky musical, the kind of film they don't make anymore, remember, had done $151 million at the US box office. The international box office for the movie was $297 million for an overall take of $448. Now, put that into the scheme of Lionsgate, which is one of the upcoming majors. It's not quite at the major level, but it's you perceive its biggest hit to be John Wick Chapter 3, for instance, outside of the Hunger Games movie. John Wick Chapter 3 did $330 million worldwide. La La Land outgrossed that. But then La La Land went into infamy for another reason as well, which, I mean, I'm sure you know this bit. It got award nominations again and no shortage of them. When the Academy Awards came round, I mean, Hollywood embraced a Hollywood story. I think it was 14 Academy Award nominations in the end. Best Picture, Director, Actor, Actress, Screenplay, Cinematography, Costumes, everything. And it won quite a few as well. It won Production Designer, it won the Original Song, it won the Original Score, it won Cinematography, it won Emma Stone a Best Actress Oscar, and Damien Chazelle became the youngest ever recipient of the Best Director Oscar in his early 30s. The film's name, of course, was read out as the winner of Best Picture. It was Faye Dunaway and Warren Beatty presenting that year. Mistakenly so, is one of the most famous Academy Award clips in recent years. Moonlight won the Best Picture that year, even though La La Land's name was read out. And I think Moonlight is a terrific film as well. I also think La La Land is a terrific film as well. And for a little while, the conversation about La La Land seemed to be as much about an Oscar mishap than anything else. But then more and more, as it's found its way back onto disc, onto streaming services and such like, La La Land is again getting the recognition that it deserves. And it's interesting that as much as Hollywood doesn't make them anymore, this old style jazz musical that grossed $450 million at the global box office, well, it doesn't look like anyone's made one since either. Just for the minute, La La Land stands alone as a modern movie. I don't see any chance of that changing anytime soon either. Which all brings me to the end of this latest episode of Film Stories. Thank you so much for listening. You can get more of my waffle if you can tolerate it at Simon Brew on Twitter. You can find the entire Film Stories project at Film Stories Pod. Website, oh yeah, got one of them, filmstories.co.uk, updated every weekday with movie news, with reviews, with features, all sorts of movie mayhem on there. If you go to store.filmstories.co.uk, meanwhile, you can find all of our back issues of magazines. There's over 30 different issues to pick from now, as well as our Sneakers Blu-ray that's not available in stores, that comes with brand new extra features that we worked really hard to do. Thank you for all the kind words people have been sending to us about that Blu-ray. We are looking at doing more as well. And as I mentioned, I have another live show coming up in September in Birmingham. You can find out all about that on the website, filmstories.co.uk. For now, though, the most important thing is you, that you look after yourselves, you take care. Thank you for your eardrums. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for putting up with me. I'll be back soon with another bunch of film stories. You all take care. Bye-bye.
I'm the guy who does his job. You must be the other guy.